I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is art critic and historian Hal Foster, who examines the life and work of legendary San Francisco-born sculptor Richard Serra, whose site-specific steel structures can be seen throughout the Bay Area, including UCSF's Mission Bay campus, Gap headquarters in San Francisco, Cantor Arts Center at Stanford University, Oliver Ranch in Sonoma County, and San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. Hal Foster is joined in conversation by Gary Garrels, Senior Curator of Painting and Sculpture at SF MoMA. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Hal Foster and Gary Garrels.
Hal Foster needs little by way of introduction. A distinguished historian, critic, and longtime professor at Princeton University, he's produced some of the most influential and dynamic work on contemporary art. His acclaimed books include The Anti-Aesthetic, Bad New Days, Design and Crime, The Return of the Real, and The Art-Architecture Complex. His latest book, Conversations About Sculpture, is co-authored with Richard Serra. It offers revelations into Serra's prolific six-decade career and practice and why he remains such a powerful and enduring force in the contemporary art world. Appearing with Hal Foster this evening is Gary Garrels, Elise S. Haas Senior Curator of Painting and Sculpture at SF MoMA, a position he assumed in 2008. His numerous exhibitions include Jasper John's Seeing with the Mind's Eye, American Icons, Masterworks from SF MoMA and the Fisher Collection, and Richard Serra Drawing, a retrospective. Most recently, he helped lead the museum's campaign for art for the Department of Painting and Sculpture, SF MoMA's Ambitious Collections campaign. Let's give Gary and Hal a warm welcome to the JCC.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you, Stephanie, for the nice introduction and thank you all for coming. I'm actually Hal, and this is Gary. So I thought I would talk a little bit about Serra. He's a hometown kid. And talk a little bit about the book, and then Gary can have at me. And we wanted to get his voice into the room, too. Serra is a fierce interlocutor, and the real pleasure and the real pain of this project for me was to be in a dialogue with him for years that was like a gladiatorial battle. I learned so much. Anyway, so Richard Serra was born in San Francisco in 1938. His father was of Spanish extraction. His mother came from a Russian Jewish family. He was born into the working class. He grew up in the sand dunes. As a teenager, worked in the steel mills in the Bay Area. One of the first things he says to me is how proud he was to see the Crown Cellarback building go up because he knew that there were rivets that he had made that were in the building. He has important early experiences in the city that I want to just tell you about. Serra's very good, as many artists, many writers are, about origin stories to explain the work, explain the career. And we have to believe them a bit. I mean, Gary has heard these stories too, but they're two specific to San Francisco that I want to tell you. He says that when he was three, maybe four, so right in the middle of World War II, when his father was a pipe fitter in the shipyards here, he was taken to a ship launch, and he was overwhelmed by the size of the ship and its weight, and then even more struck by how this hook of a thing began to move down the waves, and he said he was terrified by this event. And as it crashed into the water, he thought it would disappear, and then it righted and found its balance. And this experience of weight and lift and balance, he said it never left him, and he still dreams about this event. Another San Francisco-specific story is, again, he grew up on the dunes, and he said as just a boy, he decided to walk as far as he could down the beach in one direction, and so he did. And at the moment when he turned, when he pivoted back towards home, he felt for the first time that the world was one thing as he moved in one direction and an entirely different world as he moved in the other direction. And that when he pivoted, the world turned with him, that his body actually sutured these two worlds together. And if the first anecdote gives you a sense of how important in his early work the whole play with props, with balance and counterbalance is, the second anecdote suggests his mature definition of sculpture, which is really to do with how a work will lead your body through a space in time. And it's really about your corporeal experience with the work in space and time that is important to him. That's what sculpture is to Sarah. Anyway, back to the story. He's a very good athlete, wins a scholarship to Berkeley to play football, breaks his back as a freshman, discovers that the art department, he always drew, he was always interested in art, the art department sucked at Berkeley. He became interested in literature, so he transferred to Santa Barbara and was very taken by the transcendentalists like Emerson and the existentialists like Camus. This is the late 1950s, where existentialism was everywhere. He was also taken up by two painters in the art department at Santa Barbara, two muralists, who encouraged him to go to Mexico to see the Mexican muralists, you know, Rivera, Orozco, Siqueiros. So he did, and he was so impressed by how such work took on the architecture, how ambitious such painting was in relation to its context, and this idea that any art should really take on the architecture stuck with him as well. He got a scholarship to Yale, which was the great art school at the time. In many ways, it still is. He was one of the...
Can I just say, based on his drawings?
On his drawings, yeah. Gary did a drawing show, and I want to ask him about his drawing show. Very important show. So he was one of the last students of Joseph Albers, the great Bauhaus master. And Albers stressed in all his teaching the importance of materials, often non-art materials. You know, what does the material want to be? And I think this really stuck with Sarah. Won a fellowship or two.
But what he did for Albers was work on the layout of the Interaction of Color book, which...
Yeah, famous book, yeah. About, well, the interaction of color.
Which it's really interesting that's what Richard did with Albers, because yeah. You know, color's not been so important in Richard's own work.
Well, we should talk about this. Yeah. These are all the images in the book, and some will be in color, but they're not in color in the book. Sarah insists on black and white throughout his publications. And why that might be so is a question we could take up. Anyway, I'll rush through the story. So he goes to Europe, mostly in Paris. He's still a painter at this point. He travels to Madrid, goes to the Prado, sees Velázquez, especially the Las Meninas, the great painting of the court, thinks, what more can be done with painting? This is a painting that does everything. He ditches painting, this is at least what he tells me, at that point, comes back to Paris and draws every day in the studio of Brancusi, which was given to the French state. And he's obsessed by Brancusi, obsessed by Giacometti, still very much alive. He stalks Giacometti and Montparnasse. Those are his two important touchstones in terms of modern sculpture. He's in Paris with Phil Glass. Sarah has a knack. He just finds the contemporaries that one would hope to find. So he's with the composer Phil Glass in Paris. They travel some. Comes back to New York after a year and a half or two. Falls in again with the smartest people around. Steve Reich, other great composer, minimalist composer, lives down the street. Great filmmaker Michael Snow is an early friend. Hilariously, Sarah has a truck. So they decide to make money. They will become movers. And he went to Yale with Chuck Close. So the movers, these guys in this group were Glass, Reich, Chuck Close, Michael Snow, and Spalding Gray. I mean, would you want those guys to move anything? Anyway, this is a very different New York, a very different downtown. One day when they're moving, on Canal Street, they see a rubber factory that's gone out of business and rubber is dumped on the street. And Sarah, because he has the truck and he's interested in material, asks the bereft owner if he can take the rubber away, and he does. And that becomes a crucial first material for him. It's the same with lead. How does Sarah get onto lead? You know this?
Yeah.
How does he?
Philip Glass was a plumber. and he was working with lead, and Richard said, wow, that could be something interesting to use.
And Glass was his studio assistant at that point. I mean, that's how ad hoc everything was back then. Another really important influence in New York was Judson Church Dance. Sarah goes to see the choreography of Yvonne Rainer, Trisha Brown, Lucinda Child, Simone Forti. These are all people who are important to San Francisco too. And that if you think about that dance, it's all about simple gestures, about how bodies interact, how they hold each other up. His prop pieces, in many ways, come directly out of that sense of dance as a matter of lift, balance, counterbalance. Really important to him, what he picks up. And he says at one point in the book that we were all makers and doers. That they didn't really think too much in terms of mediums, although he insists on sculpture, and that they were all the audience for each other. I mean, they really were devoted. He also went to the anthology film archives every night, so he says, and really studied film. Yeah. So that, those early years, this is now mid to late 1960s, are really important in New York. And soon after, He breaks out into space. This is how he defines it. He discovers that a plate stuck in a corner will freestand, as in strike. And this is his first move, really, into the space of the gallery. And this idea that all his work must freestand. And this piece is more about an opening out into that space and how different materials can define it. He has problems with the other earthwork artists. He's more interested in the manipulation of space. He feels that Michael Heiser and Robert Smithson, that too much of land art is simply drawing in space. It's too graphic. So he steps away from it for a bit. But the book takes you through the formation of his work, through the early stages, the break into space, the landscape work, the whole idea of site specificity. We move on to the torque pieces, which is another great moment of invention in his work. In the latter half of the book, or the latter third, we talk more openly about his commitments in modern sculpture, sculpture of other traditions. He's very curious about other cultures. There's a chapter about his engagement with architecture. Sarah goes to architecture in part because he feels that sculpture lacks structural principles, and he wants to draw on the tectonic strength of architectures, and which he finds in all kinds of different examples historically. So there's a whole chapter devoted to architecture, and then eventually we get to the controversies in his career, the controversies in his life, most significantly Tilted Arc, the site in New York that piece in New York that was commissioned by the government that was also taken down by the government. The 30th anniversary of its destruction is tomorrow. So we can talk a little bit about such things if you want. And then we end the book with, I press him on the contradictions in his work, and that gets nasty. Anyway, I've gone on long enough.
No, I wanted to ask, I mean, I have to say, I've known Richard, I guess I met in 79, really early for me. And anyway, as you mentioned at the beginning, Richard is just a formidable intellectual. And he has very little patience for pretense. He has no patience for pretense. He's direct, and he has very strong ideas, and he is just he's a formidable person. I mean, I have to say, I find Richard incredibly. Also, there's a warmth about him and an engagement. But you have to be absolutely honest, and if you don't know something, you have to admit it. Because there's nothing worse than like pretending you know something that you don't. And so, anyway, I've been reading the book, but I have to say, so how did this conversation begin, and how many years? Because this, I have to say, it is a kind of formidable accomplishment. This long series of conversations with Richard covered over a number of years, and clearly the two of you have a relationship where you can be. Sort of really confront Richard and ask him some tough questions and have some opinions that may differ from the ones he has about mm-hmm. about his work.
Yeah, no, I think we both understood that to make a conversation, we had to be honest and we had to be clear about our disagreements. And my favorite parts, I think his too, are when we do disagree. Yeah, and there are the only two things that Sarah asked me to take out of the book. And one was in my preface when I said that the early conversations had the narrative arc of Godzilla meets Bambi. And he said, "Who's Godzilla here?"
When did those conversations start? How long does this...
Well, it's funny. I didn't know that you knew him longer than I did. I met him. I met Sarah in 1983 at the Odeon when that restaurant was still a hangout for artists and writers downtown. And actually, he was with Frank Gehry, so I met Gehry at that point too. And he, I think he was interested in me. I was just a young critic, editor at Art in America, because I was. Already identified with the pictures generation. And Sarah's very, people like Cindy Sherman and Barbara Kruger, Louise Lawler, and Sarah is so rivalrous. He wanted to know who these new kids on the block were, and he wanted to, in a way, see if they were a threat. so that was, he really came up to me. And this was just at the moment when Tilted Arc had gone up. I mean, it was... Tilted Arc was installed in 1981, and it was before the controversy. And so I stuck with him. I testified at the hearings about Tilted Arc. I didn't testify with the enthusiasm that Sarah required, so we fell out of touch for a few years. Mm-hmm. But we came back into conversation with the Torque pieces in the early 1990s, and we haven't really stopped.
You're listening to art critic and historian Hal Foster, whose latest book is Conversations About Sculpture, which examines the life and work of legendary San Francisco-born sculptor Richard Serra. Hal Foster is joined in conversation by Gary Girrells, Senior Curator of Painting and Sculpture at SF MoMA, on Bina. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So we've talked for 3 decades, really. But the book comes out of about 2 decades of conversations. We began to do talks in public and then in private, and then we discovered how much material we had. And I edited. But he is, as you say, he's fiercely articulate, and, you know, so it was actually fairly easy to put together as a book, because he, you know, we really march through problems. And he's committed. I mean, some artists don't really want to fess up, you know. They don't really want to explicate the work. Serra's the opposite. He's a he feels that it's incumbent upon an artist to not only take a position, but to clarify the position. And that, for me, is key.
One of the things that Richard remarks upon too is that that he can look at and be interested in art from any period. He says that it's not as if art history has a march of one thing eliminating another, but it's a something where it's an accumulation. Even though, as he wants to create it in a totally new way, to do something that has not been seen or done before, mm-hmm. he also is acutely aware of, like you said, Velázquez or Giacometti.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be interested to hear you on the subject as a curator, because for Serra, and this comes up more than once in the book, and I think this is typical of other artists, for Serra, all art, all architecture is somehow present. He feels that he can learn from Donatello as well as Praxiteles, or he can learn from the Hagia Sophia or a dolmen in Ireland.
Zen gardens in Kyoto.
Yeah, no, that a trip to Japan in 1970 was really important to this idea that sculpture be about a body as it moves through space and time, and that kind of move from detail to the, you know, the entire totality of the garden. That's crucial. He's always, you know, curious about other art, other architecture, other times, and it's all present for him, because a fundamental value too, and this is true of his generation, I think, is that the experience of art is in the experience of art. It's in the phenomenological here and now. So you can come up to anything, any work of art, any building of any time, any culture, and it's about your experience of it now. So that brings it all right to the present, and how we're compelled, he thinks, to engage in any work in the present, in, you know, with our body, in with all our present with us. At the same time, he has this other temporality in the development of his work, which is that he feels that an artist must take on the most important precedents in his or her medium. So he has a very Oedipal sense of how art develops, that you have to kill the father. And too often, this is a real boy story, I think, but there's a way in which he wants Donald Judd and Dan Flavin, you know, two artists that he felt that he had to surpass or overcome somehow. He wants them to come back so he can kill them. You know, he's that intense in terms of his kind of artistic agon, you know? So that's one temporality, but this other temporality is even more important, that all art is there to be engaged with.
Yeah.
But that's different for, certainly different for an art historian. Is that how you, as a curator, think about art?
Well, I mean, I think about, again, that all these things can exist simultaneously, and you can put together different relationships that may not be intended, but you somehow may feel that there exists that. I mean, I think for a curator, and maybe that is a little different than an art historian, the primary engagement is with the object, with with the work of art. And I think that's something curators share with artists.
Right.
That it's not the... even though, again, with Richard, the ideas are... He's driven by ideas, but he is also driven by material.
Right.
So as you said, some of the very first sculptures were rubber, because rubber was something he found. It was available. He could experiment with it. He could bring it back to the studio and sort of test it, kind of see what could you do with this material? What forms would it take?
Yeah, what does it want to be?
What does it want to be? And then shortly after that, he started working with rubber silicon casting. And one of the pieces in the SF MoMA collection that is a cast of doors made out of a rubber silicon kind of mix. And they were doors of a warehouse near his studio. I believe it was an abandoned railroad warehouse. I can't remember for sure. But again,
it was just on the Hudson. It was the Piers.
Yeah. But again, so even really early on, and then from there, I think the next step was the lead.
Yeah.
And again, finding out what can you do with lead. So this was discovered lead because it was something Phil Glass was using as a plumber. And, you know, what did he do with it? And then Richard takes it out of its functional context just as a raw material and says, well, what can I do with this? And one of the things that he always says, and I got this out of the book, and I hope, Hal, you'll read maybe a little bit from the book, because Richard's language is also so, I think, compelling. But it's... That he's always interested in finding a new form, something that has not been seen before.
Right.
And so with lead, and we'll maybe get back to these, but you know, he starts with the lead. The first piece is taking a melted lead. Lead melts at a very low melting point. I think it's the lowest melting point of any metal. And then once the heat's off, it immediately starts solidifying. So the first piece that he does with the lead is melting it and throwing it into the corner, the meeting point between the floor and the wall. And it's that pressure point in architecture, and seeing what will happen there. And basically it's the visual destruction of that corner, and then the lead setting up, and then pulling that lead out. That's the first one from the Castelli Warehouse show in 68, where it's just in the space itself. And then he decides he can repeat that action and see what happens through the repetition of action and the building up of form, and then prying it out of the corner and pushing it into the space and repeating that action. There's just, again, this kind of logic that just keeps...
Yeah.
Running through the
work. Logic of materials and processes. I mean, by the way, perhaps the best collection of early work by Sarah is at the SF MoMA. So I encourage you to encourage Gary to get it out.
Yeah, none of which is on view.
It's been there.
It's been up. We have to give other artists a chance every now and then too.
Yeah. Sarah is a space guzzler. Maybe we can talk about that too at one point. But there's. There's a way in which Sarah felt that he could get beyond minimalists like Judd and Flavin through this attention to material and process. So the verb list was very important in his career. It gets him started with actual activities in relation to materials like lead. And he says that artists like Judd, they're shiny minimalists. Whereas, my group, and he counts as among his group, Bruce Nauman, Robert Smithson, Eva Hess. He also sneaks in Andy Warhol. He says, we are the down and dirty minimalists. But he does give it up to one one minimalist, Carl Andre. And let me just read. So this is Sarah on Carl Andre. He says, I was very interested in Andre because he always dealt with the physicality of matter. Different kinds of wood, different kinds of metal. He went through the whole chart. Copper, lead, zinc, aluminum, magnesium. One day I said to Carl, look, somebody's got to get those plates up off the floor. And he looked at me, smiled, and said, don't worry, Richard, somebody will. I thought, oh God, I better do it. So I took four lead plates. If you put the four of them together, they weigh a ton, and dragged them up to my studio one at a time in the elevator. I thought by leaning them together and overlapping them at the top edge, I could get them to freestand. It's really important to Sarah. And when I did, it looked like a house of cards. Even though it seemed it might collapse, in fact, it stood up. You could see through it, look into it, walk around it. And I thought, there's no getting around it. This is sculpture. Now, was it sculpture, as sculpture had been heretofore known? No. But was I willing to stake my belief on what I was up to, on unattached lead plates propped up against each other, weighing a ton, and always about to implode, to stake my belief on them being sculpture? Yes. Just as much as Andre was when he laid one brick after the other to make lever and people yelled at him, that's not art. The stakes were very serious and very high. A lot of what we were doing downtown was experimental, but that doesn't mean we didn't know what the historical responsibilities were. I was thinking about Brancusi and Giacometti. I looked at them every day when I was in Paris. Closer to home, I was thinking about Johns and a host of others. We knew what the odds were in terms of finding our own way of doing and making that was going to challenge what came before us. I think all of us felt that what we needed to do to make our own syntax, to define ourselves as artists, not to make somebody else's work, to make our own. I got divorced over House of Cards. Nancy Graves, his wife at the time, asked if I was going to show it as sculpture. I said yes. And she said she couldn't live with me anymore.
Okay, and I have another version of that story because in the Fisher Collection is a later version of House of Cards, which is slightly larger than the first time he did it. And when we did the drawing, when I did the drawing show with Richard, we have this piece, which is a later rendering of the splashing piece. It disappears behind a wall sometimes. Sometimes it comes out. It's there now if you want to see it on the fourth floor. It's permanent. It was made on the site. And when we did the drawing show, I thought, well, we've got House of Cards. We've got the splashing piece sort of anchored and to give people a little sense of where Richard was coming from in his thought process, and then did a big gallery of rubber and the cast resin pieces and these different and leather. And I was walking through with Richard, and we're at the House of Cards, and he says, yes, when I first did this piece, I was married to Nancy Graves. And she said to me, well, that's not sculpture. And he said, well, then you're not my wife. So it was a little different narration than what appears in the book. So I don't know, that was maybe off the record, I don't know. But anyway, it was pretty similar to what you just read. Formidable.
Yeah.
So I wanted, again, this splashing piece, which is so fundamental, it's a kind of, again, an origin story. So when, and so he did that piece for a show at a Castelli, Leo Castelli had a warehouse, and they did a show of these early. And I would say I would call them post minimalists.
Sure,
you know, Hesse, Nauman, that process, and again the the inherent quality of those materials was really fundamental, and that they were related actually to the human body and the organic forms. It was like, where the minimalists had tried to get the body as far away as possible, Richard and this generation were trying to embrace the relationship to the body.
And even in that first splashing piece, there's a relation to architecture.
So yes, absolutely.
Implicit there is already this move into space and this agon with architecture. It, I mean, Sarah has drawn on architecture, again, for structural reasons, but there's also a real conflict there. He really wants to take on architecture and in many ways to expose it when it's not fully transparent in its own structure and production.
Right. And again, it's relationship of the body in space, which is a relationship to the objects he's making, but it's also to the architectural frame or as he goes out into the environment.
You know, you mentioned your interest in prime objects. For Sarah, this is one of his prime objects because he sees a connection between this very early piece where he simply had a sheet of rubber and lifted it up and it free stood. So he said, well, is that sculpture? Maybe, maybe not, but yes. That formed a topology, a continuous surface. And that idea comes back years later in the torqued pieces, this idea of a sculpture, which is all, if you like, surface. So one thing that we talk about, and I mentioned it because you said you were interested in it, is this idea of prime objects, which is an idea from the great Mesoamerican art historian George Kubler, who wrote a book very influential to Sarah Smithson and many others called The Shape of Time in the early 1960s. And he develops this idea of how a tradition of art shifts in relation to particular inventions, particular innovations, which Kubler calls prime objects. And it's led Sarah to think about, you know, now that he's worked for over 60 years, to think about the prime objects in his own career. I mean, works that triggered a whole new line of work, works to which he can return to develop new work. It's an important idea in his process.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually, because it's so compelling, I had never encountered this term in relationship to Richard until the reading the book. But Richard himself defines it as inventing something that is not anticipated.
Right. Yeah, that sense on radical, that value of radical innovation, that's absolutely key to Sarah. You know, when he thinks about significant artists, that's the criterion.
Yeah. And those
innovations don't displace other innovations. You know, he says, you know, Cézanne does not displace Manet, et cetera, et cetera. That one can still draw from all of them. Right. But they all need to qualify as great for him. And, you know, we can talk about his fetish of the master, the masterpiece, but to qualify as great, they have to innovate within the art.
Right. But they also have to, then the prime object allows more invention.
Yeah.
That, like with that rubber piece. So the rubber piece was just from manipulating the rubber, and suddenly there's a form that hadn't existed before, a sculpture that hadn't existed before. But that sculpture is there and embedded then within Richard's work so that he can circle back to it and revisit it and turn it into something else later, which are...
Right.
Basically the torqued ellipses.
Yeah, I mean, let me just share another epiphany that he relates in the book. And this has to do with architecture. And it's about how to get to another prime object, if you like. This occurred much later than the San Franciscan ones. When he's about 50, he's in Rome, and he goes to one of the masterpieces of Baroque architecture, this San Carlo church by Borromini. The composition of this church, for all its complicated surfaces, is quite simple. There's an ellipse on the floor, and the floor is an ellipse, and the ceiling is an ellipse. Sarah came in to the church by a side aisle, and he thought that these two ellipses were twisted in relation to each other. And he felt that he had never experienced that space in nature or in architecture. And he wanted to recreate it. And that was the beginning of the Torque pieces from the early 1990s on. And that's a series of work that continues. But he also refers it back to that first piece to lift, where he just simply took that sheet of rubber and lifted it up.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is art critic and historian Hal Foster, whose latest book is Conversations About Sculpture, which examines the life and work of legendary San Francisco-born sculptor Richard Serra. Hal Foster is joined in conversation by Gary Gerrels, Senior Curator of Painting and Sculpture at SF MoMA. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And just like the visit to Kyoto and seeing the gardens there was what really led him to the first work out in the landscape, to take him out of architecture.
To the importance of sight. And, Serra's in many ways the inventor of the idea of sight specificity. And,
In our time.
Yeah, sure. But when we speak, when we use this term, it refers in many ways to his development of the idea.
The Baroque artists were pretty good at it, too.
Yeah.
Caravaggio, maybe.
But, his definition was really developed in large part in relation to Tilted Arc. Many people think that sculpture just sat on the site, on the plaza, Federal Plaza in Lower Manhattan. But it's actually embedded in the site. It's a section of a cone, not a cylinder. So it's actually impaled, this is the term Serra uses, in the site. So that for Serra to move such a sculpture, to move to the dark, is to destroy it. And that became his definition, his negative definition of site specificity. If you move a site-specific work, you destroy it. And that was his claim in relation to that piece.
Yeah, and I have to say, I did see that piece and spent some time with it after it first went in. I'd moved to New York in 1984, and that was like something to really explore. And it was, as you said, the cone, but it was also it was about the relationships between the buildings and the plaza, and it was taking the whole thing as a gestalt. And by adding that piece of large curved plate of steel, it suddenly changed those relationships in that place. And this was a very unorganized space.
Yeah.
It was a very awkward, oddball set of like kind of leftover space. And by doing the tilted arc, he suddenly made it meaningful within this space, and made the space have a legibility that you never would have had before. The unfortunate part was that you couldn't traverse the plaza anymore.
Well, and you had to go around it.
You had to make a big detour. And if you were working in that building or any of those buildings every day and going out for lunch, whatever, you sort of had a forced march, and which very quickly became a lot of angry workers.
There was a hearing, and I mentioned I testified at the hearing, but eventually the piece was taken down and by his lights destroyed in 1989. Can I just read from this moment? Because we disagree on the question of sight. And I think for me, this is an important moment in the book. So I quote him, say, "In 1985, this is just when the hearings about Tilted Arc began, you wrote, 'I do not necessarily worry about the indigenous community. I'm not going to concern myself with what they consider to be adequate, appropriate solutions.'" I mean, this is, in a way, the difference between a sculptor and an architect. "You made that statement before artists had done much to develop the social aspects of site specificity. Still, it reads provocatively today." This is Serra. I'll stand by that one, even if it pisses a lot of people off. "For me, the whole idea that art is democratic is nonsense. I've gotten a lot of flack for that position. if you cater to the demographics of a given context, you risk serving ever-fluctuating political positions. You become a pawn in shifting ideological arguments. This is me. Might it be that you're so inside your language, so attuned to its nuances, that you're not always alert to conditions that are already there, embedded in the context, conditions that are social, economic, and political? Does your very insistence on the formal, structural, and phenomenological aspects of your sculpture end up being a way, inadvertently, to deflect certain realities of urban life, even though you say the experience of those realities is a primary concern of your work? Sarah, I'll restate what I previously said. If you go into a community to make a work and you try to follow the demands of the local people, which are never homogenous anyway, you end up serving their interests more than your own, and usually their interests are transitory. Most of those communities change over time. The demographics shift. Politics change. Political representatives change. So you have to hold fast to your own work. Me. But don't you then divide sight from context, treating sight as primarily physical and context as primarily social, privileging the former and bracketing the latter? No, I'm dealing with context. I'm just not treating the community as the preeminent arbiter of context. That's the difference. Me, but why assume the community isn't the preeminent arbiter?
So there's one piece of Richard's that I find incredibly emotionally moving, and it certainly is about physical context, but it's also about history and morality and place. And I was on the committee that selected art and artists for the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and lobbied very hard that Richard should do something in that museum. And I had a couple of allies in that. And Richard proposed a piece. How many people have been at the Holocaust Museum? So at the bottom of the stairs, there's this massive slab that just cuts into the building, and it is at the base, the bottom of the building, right. And it's this wrenching of architecture. And as you mentioned, Richard's mother was Jewish, and I think that there's some part of that identity that is important to Richard and that history. And he was actually very interested in doing this piece, doing a work for the Holocaust Museum. Mm-hmm. And to me, that piece is perfectly attuned to the site, the architecture, the physical context, but it also has a metaphorical and emotional value that I think is not typically what one thinks about with Sarah's sculpture.
Yeah, I mean, there is a dialectic in his work between weight and weightlessness. I mean, the curvy pieces, the torque pieces are almost lift you up. They're very fast. But the counterpoint to such pieces are pieces like Gravity in the Holocaust Museum, where he goes back to that experience of the ship launch, you know, the weight. And that's come back strongly in his work, too. I mean, he's done other pieces, a beautiful piece called The Drowned and the Saved, an allusion to Primo Levi, of course. A very simple piece, just two right angles that abut and support each other, as perhaps The Drowned and the Saved in Levi do, through memory. That piece was first installed at a synagogue in Germany. So, there are different moments in his work where he's reflected in his own formation, his own family, his own history, but it's always through his language. It's always through abstraction, you know, that insistence on an abstract syntax. He's also very involved in the memorial in Berlin with Peter Eisenman. If you know that sea of stelae of pillars near the Brandenburg Gate, you know that that's more Sarah than Eisenman, really. But Sarah withdrew because Helmut Kohl, the chancellor at the time, wanted to cut cut the area of the memorial down, and Sarah refused. And he felt that as an artist, again, this insistence that one should not have to deal with politicians, and he's had other controversies with politicians, he felt that, you know, that Eisenman as the architect could stick it out, but he as an artist had to withdraw just ethically. Yep. But there are these moments when he deals with history, but he does so through his own abstract language.
Yeah.
I wanted to read a little bit more, and you know, on this very subject of weight, of gravity, and how it's come back in his own work recently. You know, Sarah turned 80 just about when the book appeared. He's not well right now. He's, you know, very, very strong as a personality. He was stressed, but he's not well.
He has 3 shows opening in September.
Yeah, well, he carries on. He has actually a very tricky form of cancer.
Yeah.
But this state, you know, his condition now has led him to think about a late style. And I posed this to him several years ago, and he wouldn't have anything to do with the concept. But in a recent conversation, which comes towards the end of the book, he does. I say, do you think that with your recent work you have entered a late style? Yes. What does the term mean for you? More emphasis, more weight, more density, more tension, more introspection. More austerity, I ask him. Maybe more emotion. And then in this academic way, I mentioned the classic examples of late style, you know, late quartets of Beethoven, you know, very austere, very dissonant. Matisse, you know, return to fundamentals, but with great delight. So I ask him, in this return, do you feel more asperity or more delight? I feel both. I've gone back to forging, and weight has re-entered the proposition strongly with all its symbolic connotations. Some of the heavier pieces make some of the curvilinear work less evocative to me emotionally. The forge works register on a different psychological level. Am I conscious that this is late work? Yes. I've done a lot of drawings over the last several years. They're a return, too. I ask him, to what? What do you want to reclaim there? The nuance of the experience of making, the sheer pleasure derived from the activity of drawing. Your early commitment to the intersection of material and process, too? Yes. What's the relation between the sense of austerity in your recent work, you call it weight, and the sense of mortality in your life? I think it's one and the same. To what extent is the interest in the fundamental in the bare a contemplation of my own death? To a great extent. Different artists respond differently. This is me. Picasso became even more manically productive. We don't know what he was thinking. This is Sarah. We don't know what Matisse was thinking either, nor Titian, nor Cezanne. I think late work is very important. It makes you reevaluate the entire body of an artist's work. It's very important for me to make that review as substantial as I can. It's not about repeating. It's about analyzing. This is me. It's not necessarily involuted. It can open up a language. Sarah, hopefully, because this is when judgment occurs. If artists fall off in their late work, their earlier work is reevaluated. But let's just end our bit, anyway, of the conversation with his thoughts about his own posterity. And this, I have to say, you know, moved me. I mean, Richard usually antagonizes me. Sarah antagonizes me. He doesn't move me, but this moved me. I ask him about, you know, how he's influenced artists and architects and others. He says, how has my work been assimilated, if at all? Probably by misinterpretation. Did some people take advantage of it in ways I couldn't foresee? Yes. Do I think the work is open enough to allow people to deal with it in a lot of different ways? I hope so. Sculptors and architects will figure it out. Some performers, dancers, and others will find it useful. Or again, that's my hope. Duchamp said that you're lucky if you get 30 or 40 years. Of course, he's had a lot longer. Warhol said, all we get is 15 minutes. Who knows? The fact is, you can't know. In the end, I still believe that matter imposes its form on form. That's why it's important for me to stick with materials I understand. It's actually, I think, a fairly modest assessment of his own importance. I think we both agree, I certainly feel, that Sarah is a world historical artist. But, and this is a real contradiction, I think, and I did not take it up in the book because I think it would be too difficult for him to take on. I think he's a world historical artist without much influence on other artists. He does say that this kind of work would be impossible for a young artist to take on now. It involves too much material, too much capital. I mean, we talked about his relation to the neoliberal economy all around us. It would just take too much effort to deal with all the contingencies, all the clients that he's had to deal with. And I think that's right. For me, it's a paradox. World historical, but influential, who knows? But I think it will stick around.
Yeah, I'm not sure, because I have to say, young artists, most of them start at the same place, which is they don't have much money, and you deal with whatever is at hand in terms of sculpture and raw material, and what do you do to that material? And I actually think Richard, because of that early work, which didn't require capital,
right,
but required invention and imagination and a kind of intellectual, just this pushing himself constantly, questioning, intellectually demanding.
But work like this.
Yeah, but work like this, yeah.
I mean, there are very few mills that make the torque work anymore, or indeed even the forge work.
I mean, Richard, I have to say, I find Richard has an incredible logic and a coherence to the work, but it also... he does have contradictions and ambiguities, he allows himself places and spaces to test his own ideas and maybe to contradict himself. I think.
Yeah, I think that's right too.
Yeah. So.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was art critic and historian Hal Foster, whose latest book is Conversations About Sculpture, which examines the life and work of legendary San Francisco-born sculptor Richard Serra. Hal Foster was joined in conversation by Gary Garrels, Senior Curator of Painting and Sculpture at SF MoMA. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espelay, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.